And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country land, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They live on milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the real life, if you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and falling down the key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com, where lots more news and views for our people. And those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Lots of interesting things happening today, and here's an item out of France. And you know, some groups really do promote poison. French Jews publish a children's book that normalizes race mixing. Now, the Jews personally, Jews as a group, are very much opposed to marrying out, that is to, well, race mix, or religion mix, or race mix. But many Jewish groups are very happy to promote, to promote just that for us. Well, here's the story. The Jewish-owned company, Nathan, has published an illustrated children's book that glorifies race mixing to young, impressionable French children. Nathan, owned by the Jewish Lahen Lippmann families, is one of the few publishers in France which benefits from government contracts. So their books are read by almost all of France's comprehensive school children. Nathan has now published a sex education manual entitled How to Make Babies. The 32-page book, which is written for children from 5 years of age on, will be given to French state-run in kindergartens with millions of children in attendance. The book asks questions such as, what is it like to be in love? What does it mean to make love? As a typical example, the book depicts a mixed-race couple with a white woman and a man with Arab appearance, drawn on the pages to help children understand how to make babies. Talk about vicious indoctrination. Of course, there's nothing wrong with interracial couples, but why is it always focused on migrant men having sex with white women? We barely see a woman with a headscarf depicted as dating or having sex with a white man. Nor should we, actually. The same tendency is seen in a Swedish campaign that focuses on migrants, or these are the third worlders pouring into Sweden, having sex as well. On the website, we barely see women with headscarves dating or having sex with white men. In France, publisher Nathan is holding a leading position in three facets of the publishing business, in particular, literature, education, and reference. According to the company, education has been at the heart of its activities for more than 130 years, and they are one of France's best-known brands. Nathan is also a publisher who is no stranger to controversy. Last year, their maths book for high schoolers featured a maths problem on the drowning of migrants. Influential Jews are pushing their race-mixing agenda relentlessly today. Images of mixed couples and children flood our television and computer screens, and that's no coincidence. Nor is it there because our society is already race-mixed. It reflects the vision of many Jews of the future where whites no longer exist. They've all been race-mixed into oblivion. But Jews don't want that for themselves. Despite their whitish appearance, all Jews are race-mixed themselves. They're all walking violations of the strict laws of the Old Testament against race-mixing, which should make anyone seriously question if these Jews actually have any claim to the promises of the covenant. Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy, another Jew pretending to be French, demanded on national television that the French people race-mix with the non-white migrants or face state sanctions if they opposed. Many Jewish spokesmen seem very focused on pushing that on us. Nicolas Sarkozy, I think political labels don't mean a whole lot, but he was nominally a sort of moderate right-winger. He wasn't really, but he was supposedly on the conservative side. He actually made that statement that it was going to be important and necessary that people mix with the foreigners, mate with the foreigners, or miscegenate. And, if they didn't, there would have to be state sanctions. The state was going to tell you whom you can marry or have sex with? Don't know. Unfortunately, he got defeated, but you can see the mindset and the thinking. Well, here's a report. I have covered this matter before, but it's interesting to get a bit of an update. This is from Rebel News about an Alberta school teacher who has been found to be the anonymous person behind a terrible smear site called Anti-Racist Canada. This is a teacher who's been exposed just last week, and his name is Kurt Phillips. This is a report from Rebel Media.
In a show of incompetence, the CBC's fifth... ...who works with, employs, and shares information with members and supporters of the violent anti-government. The CBC was intending to cooperate with Phillips to conceal his identity. However, when facial images were discovered, none other than Kurt Phillips, a Catholic school teacher in Drumheller, Alberta, was exposed as the mastermind behind ARC Collective. ARC is a blog that was curated by Phillips for over a decade until he recently resigned after his mask was removed. Phillips's blog has shared the personal information, addresses, photos of homes, names, and faces of people who Phillips unilaterally determines are fascists. Rebel News reached out to Phillips. We sent him a list of questions with hopes that we could get his side of the story. However, that went completely ignored. The school was also quick to stand by Phillips, sending a letter to parents. Very hastily, Principal Joanne Ackerboom insisted that Phillips is politically neutral and doesn't bring his personal activism to the classroom. Tweets posted by an account bearing his name and photo appear to contradict the assertion he is neutral at all. As for the personal activism in the classroom, well, that also seems to be untrue, as Phillips's blog routinely posts defamatory content during the hours he is supposed to be teaching students. One might wonder exactly how much taxpayer-funded time Phillips is using to research, write, edit, and publish information that is fed to Antifa, an organization the President of the United States has considered labeling a terrorist group. Now, Antifa is a violent organization. You probably know of it. It's an organization that Phillips informs for. Testimony from avowed anti-fascists claim that Phillips is a longtime anti-fascist himself. However, Phillips rejects that. Kurt Phillips has employed someone, actually, at his blog who self-associates themselves with the violent movement. Phillips himself even jokes about being a, quote, Antifa super soldier. His blog links directly to sources calling violence morally neutral. Phillips also calls punches to the face a, quote, Antifa kiss. The teacher who teaches at a kindergarten to grade 12 school maintains he's not violent, maintains he's not Antifa. Phillips does fit the Antifa description, posting about high school humiliation and joking about beating children. He sounds like a great teacher. All this in mind, Kurt Phillips adamantly denies being a part of Antifa. He says he is neither an extremist nor a terrorist. He says that he has never promoted violence at all, and he goes on to plead his innocence, saying that he never brought the blog into the classroom at all, which contradicts the evidence that suggests he did exactly that. Many parents of students at St. Anthony's Catholic School have been reaching out to the school demanding Phillips be removed from the classroom. One of those emails was sent to Rebel News, and in it was a tweet that I hadn't seen before, but it would certainly make any Catholic angry. Mr. Phillips' ARC Twitter account retweeted a tweet saying vibrators are greater than Jesus Christ himself. Big oof. Now, something I was surprised to see was Phillips being so defensive about being called a terrorist. I hadn't seen that allegation myself, so I looked into it. After an anonymous poster on the website Kiwi Farm shared this expose, people took to the streets of Drumheller to post these leaflets around the town, especially around the school where parents will pick up their children. The poster accuses Phillips of being a, quote, political terrorist, and that he stalks and harasses victims as young as 14. That would be about as young as his own students. Phillips' blog dates back over a decade and contains hundreds of gigabytes of information exposing mainstream conservatives and Nazis alike, often conflating and confusing the two. I'm unable to verify the contents of this poster specifically, and Rebel News has found no evidence to suggest that Phillips has engaged in any terrorist activity. I called the school to speak with both Phillips and Principal Ackerboom, and I wanted to know if Kurt had been disciplined or if he's been fired, or if he's even under investigation after the outcry of parents in Drumheller. Did the school know about Phillips' pastime before the CBC exposed him? Unfortunately, no answers were to be had after reception stonewalled it.
Is Kurt still working there?
Oh, I'm not answering any questions, sorry.
Is the principal available? I'd love to speak with Ms. Ackerboom.
Yeah, there's no one to speak with you.
Is there nobody at the school?
Oh yeah, we're all here, for sure.
Kurt
there's
is gone.
No one here to speak with you.
If you want to support the work that we're doing here at Rebel News, lifting the veil of Antifa and sharing the other side of the story.
You can see the school in full denial mode. I'm not surprised. Oh, here's another example of tolerance. Male teacher assaults female student over women for trunk pin. Female high school student in Michigan reports that she was assaulted by a male teacher when she wore a metal pin to school, voicing her support for President Donald Trump. Sadie Eargood is a junior who attends Mason High in Mason, Michigan. When the 16-year-old wore her Women for Trump pin to school, she was confronted by an angry male teacher who aggressively grabbed the pin and detached it from her jacket and just ripped it off her. The teacher, who's been identified as media technology teacher Paul Cato, first confronted Sadie, saying he didn't like her pin. "That's fine, you don't have to like it. We can have our opinions," she responded. But the teacher was not willing to let the matter go. "He grabbed it and I pulled. I tried to push his hand away and he grabbed my shoulder," she explained in an interview with a local news channel. "He just kind of put his hand there and then he started pulling more and more and I started backing up. The teacher then took both hands and unlatched the pin from my jacket and put it upside down on his shirt and said it belongs upside down," Sadie explained. The incident occurred during school hours on December the 5th. He had no right to put his hands on my child over a pin or anything else, said Sadie's mother, K.P. Eargood. He was very upset about the incident. The First Amendment gives everybody the right to express their freedom of speech. No one should get that upset about someone wearing a political pin. I was really shocked that a teacher especially would do that, Sadie said, knowing that I just want him to know that it's not okay to do that. I want this to be a learning experience for other teachers, and I'm not going to stop wearing my political stuff. Sadie's family filed a police report charging the teacher with criminal assault and larceny, but the Ingham County Prosecutor's Office declined to file assault charges against the teacher, claiming there was no credible evidence of criminal conduct. The school district conducted an investigation and released a statement which read in part, quote, following an investigation by the Mason Police Department, the Ingham County Prosecutor's Office declined to press criminal charges in the matter. Mason Public Schools officials have completed their internal investigation and have disciplined the teacher appropriately, well, at least that much. While not criminal, the teacher's actions were inappropriate and misrepresented the mission of the district, added Ronald Zierwicki, Mason Public Schools superintendent. Mason Public Schools staff are role models. Our core values include respect, responsibility, and compassion. We expect all Mason Public School staff to model these values in interactions at the school, especially with students. This is kind of a good news story. Good for the girl standing up for herself. And it just goes to show you the extremism of some of the people who teach in our schools. I mean, it's one thing to have an opinion, one thing to have an opposite opinion. But to actually, essentially, assault the student, to try to wrestle the pin off her jacket, is just appalling. Here's a very interesting piece that appeared in the National Post a couple of days ago by a man by the name of Niall Ferguson. And he's the Milbank Family Senior Fellow at the Hooper Institution at Stanford University. And he's a Senior Fellow of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard. He's the author of 15 books. The most recent of which, The Square and the Tower, was published in 2018. It was a New York Times bestseller. Anyway, this is a depressing piece, but I'm not sure I would disagree with him. And he writes, and the title of his piece is, Freedom is Dying and Youth Don't Seem to Care. And that is the way I read many of the, what might be called the millennial generation. It's always, it's always problematic to generalize about a generation. I'd be the very first to admit this, but there is some truth in this. Anyway, this is what Niall Ferguson has said. Although I regret it very much, I believe that the liberal democracy as we know it won't survive the 21st century. If you look at Freedom House data, which covers nearly all the world's countries, and you go back to 1997, about 45% of the countries were rated as free. About 30% were partly free, and about 25% were not free. That's 1997, of course, after the fall of communism in Europe. These proportions haven't really changed much in the past 20 years or so. And there are several countries that have clearly seen a decline in freedom in the past 10 years. You list Venezuela, Turkey, Hungary, I wouldn't agree with that, Hungary, and Russia. One might argue that the United States is in severe danger of, lo- of, of losing at least the liberal part of its democracy. And then he continues, liberal democracy is also struggling economically. It's not only encumbered with mind-boggling amounts of debt. Roughly speaking, the total public and private liabilities in the United States are approaching 1,000% of the gross domestic product. Liberal democracy also generated the severe crisis, financial crisis of 2008-2009, and it is afflicted with profound problems of inequality. The third point I'd make is that the internet has turned out to be deeply inimical to liberalism, not to democracy. It's not that that turnout declines. It's just that the more that the network platforms dominate the media, the worse it seems to go for liberalism, because network platforms incentivize extreme views and fake news, and hollow out the center ground of politics. And this is what the part I found particularly interesting. The final point I'll make is that I worry about the illiberalism of the young, the illiberalism of the young. As somebody who works in the university world, I'm constantly struck by how little commitment young people have to fundamental principles of liberalism, in particular, freedom of speech. And the freedoms associated with the press. Survey data reveal that Generation Z, that's the generation currently in university, are overwhelmingly skeptical about free speech and think the university should protect them from anything that might hurt their feelings. And that is, and that last sentence is truly frightening. And so he says that the Generation Z, the ones that are now in university, and he says this is backed up by surveys, are overwhelmingly skeptical about free speech. It's not a value they like, they cherish. And they think that universities should protect them from anything that might hurt their feelings, or as they sometimes put it, would trigger them. Now think about what that means. Anything that might hurt their feelings, which and that hurting their feelings will go against whatever beliefs they hold at the present time. They believe all races are equal. I mean, they've been told that since that they were in pre-kindergarten. So if you provide them with scientific evidence that there are significant racial differences, and you know, if you want to extrapolate from differences, inequalities, they don't. It's not just that they don't want to hear it; they don't think it should be allowed to be said. If they have been indoctrinated to believe that an abortion is the absolute right that every woman should have, she should have the absolute right without restriction to snuff out the life of an unborn child. And a group on campus wishes to form a pro-life club, which argues differently, that abortion is not just a matter of convenience for the woman, that there's another life at stake, etc., etc., etc. It's not just that they don't want to hear it, which is fair enough. To, you know, whatever, don't tell it. But they don't. There are many there who would be quite happy, quite content, if the student union would not certify the club or would ban them from holding meetings on campus, which has happened at many universities. And so it seems to be a lack of value, I was going to say a value of Generation Z, but the freedom of speech is not important. In fact, they're skeptical of it. What they want is to be kept in a nice, warm little cocoon where nobody challenges where nobody challenges their views, and which would hurt their feelings. See, feelings are very important to that. I just want to feel good. I don't want to feel stressed. Well, which of us actually wants to feel stressed? Well, nobody. But that doesn't mean the system should be constructed so that you don't feel stress. The attitude reflected by that is profoundly childish, childlike. And these people are at university, which is the place where their ideas should be challenged. For one thing, they should be learning new things, not just confirmation of whatever sketchy baggage that they came into the university with. And I'm not saying that everything you believe will be changed after university, but you should be exposed to other ideas, other concepts. And having had that exposure, perhaps you will change some of your ideas, perhaps you will not. But that's what traditionally universities have done. First of all, provided advanced knowledge. But secondly, challenged students to think. Now, thinking is not the same thing as simply repeating what you've already believed. In fact, universities, far from making students feel safe, should challenge them, make them feel a little bit unsafe, on edge. You may have thought this is true, but here's some evidence that it's not true. Think about it. That, especially in the social sciences, is being run out of many universities as they have come under the sway of the cultural Marxists, who are not there to do research or to advance knowledge, but are really there to indoctrinate. And many of Generation Z are quite content with that. They don't want discussion or debate. They just want to feel safe. That is, of course, intellectually catastrophic. If we are going to continue to advance as a civilization, continue to advance in the sciences, we have to be prepared to be challenged. We have to be prepared to reassess ideas. That doesn't mean that all the ideas we have are wrong. Of course not. But if we don't reassess things, we will lose creativity. If we're not prepared to reassess things, we will lose that creativity. And creativity is what really spurs progress. I find this profoundly disturbing. Well, here was a big setback for freedom in Canada, and it occurred on Friday. This is more another example of judicial tyranny, of out-of-control judges, just jackbooting the fundamental rights. The Appeals Court of British Columbia. Yeah, the British Columbia Court of Appeal also ruled Friday that the 13-year-old daughter was old enough to consent to testosterone treatment. Now, this is a case that's bounced its way around the courts in BC for a couple of years. The British Columbia Court of Appeal ruled Friday that a 13-year-old girl was old enough to consent to testosterone shots despite her father's objections that his troubled daughter had been influenced by transgender advocates and did not understand the long-term consequences of her decision. I would argue that at 13, she's not really achieved the maturity to make life-changing decisions. At 16, at 13, she's not allowed to drive. She's not allowed to consume alcohol. But on the basis, well, she may not be physically able to handle it. She may not fully realize what it can do to her, and so on. But apparently, she's old enough to consent to testosterone treatment. The troubled kid wants to go from female to male. But this is only the beginning of the jackbooting of the rights of the parent. The appeal ruling, released January 10, also placed the father under a conduct order, effective until April, that directs him to acknowledge his now 15-year-old daughter as a male, to use male pronouns when referring to her, and to call her by her chosen male name. Now, this is a male, incidentally. Oh, wait a second. This is a female. Oh, sorry, that's the daughter. So, the father is now compelled to speak. You see, Canada's pernicious anti-hate laws have traditionally criminalized certain things that you do say. Now, though, under pain of punishment, you've got to say things you don't believe in. He does not believe the girl is a boy. Or I would say, scientifically, medically, and religiously, he's correct. This disturbed kid is not a boy. It's a girl who may want to be a boy or think she is a boy, but she's not a boy. Under a publication ban on any information that could identify the names of the parties, the father is referred to as CD and the daughter as AB. This endless secrecy. Quote, while of course CD is fully entitled to his beliefs and opinions, he cannot forget that AB, now a mature 15-year-old, with the support of AB's mother, now the ruling says his, but AB is a girl, and AB's medical advisors has chosen a course of action that includes not only hormone treatment, but a legal change of name and gender identity, reads the ruling of the BC Court of Appeals Chief Justice Robert Bauman, Justice Harvey Groberman, and Justice Barbara Fisher. The court issued a further conduct order directing the father to, quote, directly or indirectly through an agent or a third party, publish or share information or documentation relating to AB's, that's the daughter's, sex, gender identity, sexual orientation, mental or physical health, medical status, or therapies other than with lawyers and medical personnel involved in the case. So the father is not allowed to directly or indirectly publish or share information. So shut up! Yeah, this is not North Korea, incidentally. It's Canada. They allowed that the father had the right to, quote, express his opinions in his private communications with family, close friends, and close advisors, provided none of these individuals is part or connected with the media or any public forum, and provided the father obtains assurances that those with whom he shares information or views will not share this information with others. So, you know, basically, other than in private conversation, shut up. The Association for Reform Political Action Canada, one of six interveners in the case, lauded the court for striking down portions of an earlier ruling against CD, but blasted the conduct orders as infringing on the father's freedom of expression and integrity. Quote, the court seems to overlook, or at least does not discuss, how significant an infringement of freedom of thought, belief, and expression it remains to order a father to refer to AB, that's the daughter, as a male, and to use male pronouns when speaking to the daughter, and to all but a few close family members and friends. Surely, if the father disagrees with the daughter, that the daughter is a boy, the daughter will know this, and it achieves little or nothing to force the father to use words he believes to be false. Rather, it is a profound violation of his freedom, damaging to his integrity, and arguably damaging to his relationship with his daughter as well, even if that's what the daughter wants to hear. That concern was echoed by the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms, which also intervened in the appeal. Quote, the state cannot lawfully compel parents to voice agreement and support for an elective treatment which the parent believes is dangerous, harmful, and against the interests of impressionable children. The state cannot compel parents to forget their daughters and remember sons in their stead, the Justice Center said in its factum. The father who separated from his wife and who went to court last year to stop his daughter's transition was appealing Superior Court Justice Gregory Bodden's February 2019 ruling that his opposition to his daughter's transition constituted family violence. And this is where the cultural Marxist-dominated courts veer into la-la land, opposing something, criticizing it, questioning it, is not violence. Violence is a punch in the face, a slap on on the backside or something like that. He was also appealing Superior Court Justice Francesca Marzani's April protection order that threatened him, quote, with immediate arrest if he tried to persuade the daughter to abandon testosterone treatment. If he addressed the daughter by her birth name, in other words, you know, as a female, or if he referred to the daughter as a girl, or with female pronouns to her or anyone publicly or privately. That was this lunatic Judge Francesca Marzani's ruling. Well, the Court of Appeal did strike that part of it down. The upside of the appeals court ruling was that the judges struck down Marzani's ruling and substituted it with conduct orders, which, unlike protection orders, are not criminally enforced. So in other words, he won't go to jail. Oh, great! They also threw out Bowden's finding that the father's opposition to his daughter's transition was family violence under the Family Act, as without legal merit. Well, okay, just a small step. But that just goes to show how absolutely out of control some of the Canadian courts are. The LGBTQ and transgendered lobby just basically taken some of these courts over. But the appeal court upheld Bowden's ruling that the daughter could validly consent to medical treatment under Section 17 of BC's Infants Act, which has the legislative intent to recognize the autonomy of mature minors and the expertise and good faith of health care providers. The Infants Act, quote, has made it clear that health care professionals, not judges, are best placed to conduct inquiries into the state of medical science and the capacity of their patients to question minors' medical decision-making. The father had argued that the healthcare providers are promoting transitioning to his daughter, who is notably represented in court by longtime queer, and that's her own term, activist Barbara Finley. This is total jackbooting of parents' rights. The father described his daughter as very vulnerable in the February 19th article in The Federalist and said he believes she lacks the mental capacity and emotional maturity to make the decision to have testosterone treatments, which have irreversible effects. According to earlier state case documents, The daughter has been troubled since her parents separated in 2013, suffering depression and attempting suicide at least four times. She also went through a lesbian stage in grade 7, then developed an intense crush on her grade 8 gym teacher to the point where the school removed her from his class, triggering a dramatic escalation in self-harm behavior, including suicide attempts. So at that point, she still thought she was a girl, I guess. When the daughter claimed to be transgender at age 13, school staff sent her and her mother, without the father's knowledge, to a transgender activist psychologist, another one, Dr. I.J., where she began, we recommended she begin hormone therapy. This is, you know, just beyond horrific, what this whack job court has done. And, you know, parents are going to have to become a lot more militant to reassert their power in the face of these out of control courts. Well, I've got to take it, have a bit of a change of pace, man, and perhaps somewhat happier change of pace with some music here. This is a German drinking songs, and so lightening up the course here a little bit. This is Paul Frommer on the Fighting Side of Me, and we're going to hear some German drinking songs, including one that you probably all know, Ein Prosit. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, this is Paul Prohlman. You're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with the game tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada.
In days of yore from Britain's shore, would the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Our fair dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours, which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever.